From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Between January and July of 1968, the U.S. military fought an epic battle with the North Vietnamese Army at Khe Sanh. It came at a crucial moment in the Vietnam War, as the North's stunning Tet Offensive unfolded, as newscaster Walter Cronkite turned openly skeptical of the war, as LBJ announced amid anti-war protests at home that he would not seek re-election. Journalist Greg Jones has gone back to the veterans of the terrible fighting at Khe Sanh to recreate the battle and the way those then young soldiers saw it. And he looks at their homecoming from war. This hour On Point, stepping into Memorial Day weekend, the Vietnam War's Battle of Khe Sanh and the troops who fought it. Joining me now from Dallas, Texas, is Greg Jones, author of Honor in the Dust, about Teddy Roosevelt and the Imperial American Experience in the Philippines, longtime correspondent in Asia. His new book is Last Stand at Khe Sanh, the U.S. Marines' Finest Hour in Vietnam. Greg Jones, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
I should say, it's just great to hear your voice. You and I are longtime colleagues in Asia over many years. You spent about 10 years out there. I spent about the same. Many of those years overlapped quite wonderfully. It's great to have you with us, Greg. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Khe Sanh, I was touched in your foreword to the book. I mean, we'll get to the battle. It is really something to remember. Great and terrible, I think, both really do apply. But you are recalling in the beginning of this book, you were very young at the time of the Vietnam War, and you're recalling the sort of feeling of being in Washington, Arlington Cemetery. We've got Memorial Day coming here. In those years when there was so much controversy over the war, and yet at the same time so much fighting and death and sacrifice, take us back to that period and your young eyes on it, Greg.
Well, right, Tom, like a lot of backstories on books, that this one really had its seeds in my childhood. And I was born in 1959, so I was 9 years old. I turned nine in April of 1968 as the actual siege of Khe Sanh was declared over. I had grown up loving American history and military history. I grew up in a small town on the edge of the Ozarks, Poplar Bluff, Missouri. And this history that I was reading was made more real to me by the fact my mother had five brothers who had served in World War II, and her oldest brother had been killed with a B-24 bomber crew over Austria on October 1st, 1943. And this was something that I had really been aware of and the shattering impact of war. And so that really brought to life for me the experience of reading history. And then that summer, that epic year of 68, with everything that was going on in Vietnam, the assassination of Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy. My family, we took a family vacation to Washington, D.C. That August, and we were at Arlington National Cemetery, and it was just, throughout that trip, you were aware of the war going on. And in fact, my hometown paper covered the war pretty heavily, nonstop, probably a front-page article from 67 on. And when local boys went in the service, there was a little article about them. And when they died, there was a larger article. So I was very aware of the war. And then to be at Arlington that summer of 68 and the funerals that were going on and the fresh graves, it was a very affecting experience that remained with me a long time.
You remind us of how soldiers came home from the Vietnam War and how it was so different from how they've come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. Many have opposed or complained about aspects of those wars, and yet soldiers have come home to a fairly warm and respectful greeting. Thanks for your service. We've heard again and again, for many that was not the return from Vietnam. I want to look at that with you before this pre-Memorial Day show comes to a conclusion as well. Take us to Khe Sanh. That time, here we are between January and July in 1968. We're up by the demilitarized zone dividing South and North Vietnam. This is near where the Ho Chi Minh Trail comes into South Vietnam. We've got a big American combat base at Khe Sanh. And what unfolded in these months, Greg?
Well, both the American commander, General William Westmoreland, and then the Supreme North Vietnamese commander, General Vo Nguyen Giap, both sought a decisive confrontation in 1968. The North Vietnamese were obviously planning a multi-pronged effort to end the war, and that included a move against Khe Sanh, and also then the urban attacks that would be known as the Tet Offensive, in which they hoped to incite an uprising that would weaken or topple the South Vietnamese government. And General Westmoreland also was seeking a decisive confrontation, hoping to draw the North Vietnamese into a conventional showdown in which the American artillery and air power would be able to inflict a decisive defeat on the North Vietnamese. And so Khe Sanh, in a sense, with General Westmoreland, became the bait to draw the North Vietnamese out. And so the North Vietnamese obliged by late 1967 and into early 1968, they moved two divisions, about 20,000 men, and then a third division within a day's march toward Khe Sanh. And so the showdown, the stage was set, and the confrontation got underway on January 20th and 21st.
North Vietnam's General Giap looking at this rather differently, remembering how the French were broken essentially in Vietnam at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. He saw this combat base up not far from North Vietnam, remote in the hills, in a kind of valley, as Dien Bien Phu had been, as a potential, spirit breaker for Americans and American forces in Vietnam.
That's right. That and certainly there's been debate over the decades of what the North Vietnamese, what the ultimate intentions were toward Khe Sanh. Was General Giap trying to replicate Dien Bien Phu at Khe Sanh or not? And that was really a part of the story. I didn't want to get too far into the weeds, but I wanted to keep my focus on the experience of the American men on the ground. But certainly the ghosts of Dien Bien Phu hung over Khe Sanh, and it came to concern the American commanders, military and political. President Johnson had a tabletop model of Khe Sanh made by the CIA and brought to the White House Situation Room. And as early as 1967, the Marines had been looking at the potential the threat of another Dien Bien Phu, and the conclusion had been that it wasn't as remote and thus could withstand a North Vietnamese attack. But certainly Dien Bien Phu very quickly became a backdrop to what was happening at Khe Sanh.
You had 6,000 U.S. Marines at Khe Sanh, U.S. Army Special Forces there as well, a South Vietnamese Army battalion, heavily outnumbered by North Vietnamese troops who they really could barely see, at least at the beginning of all this. Describe the physical setting of this battle, how close it was to Laos, where the combat base sat exactly, the importance of the hills around it that we've come to know by numbers, Greg?
Right. Khe Sanh Combat Base sat along Route 9, which was the east-west, the old French road that ran from the coast, where Route 1 was the north-south, the main artery in South Vietnam, ran along the east coast. So Route 9 winds its way into the hills, roughly parallel to the DMZ dividing north and south. And so Khe Sanh Combat Base had been an old French fort along Route 9. There had been a French coffee plantation had been planted around it, and an old French planter and his family lived there. And the American Special Forces had been the first to plant the U.S. flag there. They had arrived in 1962. The Marines arrived about 3 years later, a small contingent, and that was gradually beefed up until the entire 26th Marine Regiment wound up at Khe Sanh for the siege. But the Khe Sanh was built around an airstrip, which by early 1968 was its only lifeline to the outside world. The road, Route 9, had been cut by communist forces, and so Khe Sanh was totally dependent on air support for its survival. And then you had the hill outposts that guarded the approaches to Khe Sanh. And so you had Hill 861 and Hill 881 South were the two most important. 861 was about 3 miles northwest of the base, and then 881 South was about 2 miles further out. And then you had a special forces camp just down the road at Long Vay, which was about 3 miles from the border with Laos. So the combat base itself, Tom, was about 8 miles from the border with Laos. And then, as you noted, the Ho Chi Minh Trail was just a few miles further into Laos, and you had all these North Vietnamese troops and materiel pouring into the war in the south. And the base itself was about 15 miles south of the DMZ.
Greg Jones, hold the thought right there. The stage is set. We're going to walk in, be walked into the Battle of Khe Sanh by Greg Jones. His new book is Last Stand at Khe Sanh, the U.S. Marines' Finest Hour in Vietnam, an epic battle that went on there for months as protests, some epic protests against the war, went on back in the United States. Were very different views. John Wayne's Ballad of the Green Berets came out in 1968, the movie The Green Berets. Used the Ballad of the Green Berets there, very patriotic song, kind of flag-waving. As the protests went on at home, the Tet Offensive would unfold. Walter Cronkite would turn away from this war. Greg Jones tells the whole story in Last Stand at Khe Sanh. You can join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Were you at Khe Sanh? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
These are men, America's best. 100 men will test today, but only 3 win the Green Beret.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking before Memorial Day weekend about Vietnam, Vietnam veterans, and the great and terrible Vietnam War battle at Khe Sanh, sound from a January 19th large air assault there against North Vietnamese troops. Sound from that day, you hear planes flying over there, the explosions of the bombs they dropped, the soldiers. It got so bad that with the Marines that they couldn't even land and bring the planes to a halt. Here from the History Channel, Vietnam War Archivist Marine medic Raymond Torres describing his arrival at Khe Sanh in 1968.
We landed in Khe Sanh and it was under mortar attack. And the plane wasn't going to stop. It was just going to slow down and we had to bail out. Once we got to Khe Sanh, then they told us that we were going to be heading up to one of the outposts. And the outposts are the hills.
Where the fighting became terrible. Here from February 23rd, sound of battle from that day. Khe Sanh. Raymond Torres here again, describing a grenade landing beside him in a trench.
Another grenade landed inside the trench. It just picked me up and just threw me against the wall. Felt, you know, intense pain. And I could feel both legs were bleeding. I could feel the blood.
6,000 U.S. Marines there, U.S. Army Special Forces, a South Vietnamese battalion, 20,000 and more North Vietnamese troops. Greg Jones writes up the whole battle after interviews with 90 of those who were there in his new book, Last Stand at Khe Sanh. Sharon's calling from Milton, Wisconsin. Sharon, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My husband served in the Marines at Khe Sanh. He was on Hill 861. And he was carrying another wounded Marine, and that Marine was shot and killed while he was carrying him. And he lay behind him for a while, and then he said he got up and he, you know, tried to run to get into shelter, and he was shot and wounded in the leg and served out the rest of his time in Japan in a hospital, and came home to despair and not much in the line of greeting or thank you for your service or anything. So that part's very sad.
How does he describe the fighting, Sharon, or does he?
Horrible. Horribly. It was a horrible, horrible thing.
Sharon, I respect your husband, and I appreciate your call. One more, if I may, in Boston. Pete's calling. Pete, you're on.
Yeah, hey, great show. One of your longtime listeners. I was with, by the way, when you get some people on, just make sure that there's a lot of wannabes. I was with 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines Hotel Company. We got into the Khe Sanh on Operation Pegasus. It was on early April 68. the battalion, we were up at Contien during the January, February, during the siege when the 26th was in there. But we're also, some of us were out of Way City. We're fighting out of Way City in February. Those of us who survived that, we went up in Contien and 2-1 and that whole operation. We got up there, as I said, around April 68. The point I guess wanted to make is that the casualties that we took up there were enormous. We had we came in there, the 26th Marines were up there, and we went in the relief, first air cav was up on that operation. After the siege broke, then we stayed, 1st Marines 1-1, we stayed up in the hills. We fought, and in fact, May 17th and 68, my company, hotel company, had a big battle up at 471. We lost a lot of people up there. I every day I think about these guys up there. 2 days later, on the 19th of May of 68, Fox 2-1 was coming out of Quezon up Route 9. They had 70 casualties within a four-hour period. They got ambushed by a battalion of NVA. And the point I guess I'm making is that people just don't understand the casualties that were in a rifle company who were up in that area. We stayed up there. We fought in those hills until July. In fact, my company, Hotel, was the last outfit. Your author mentioned July 5th. Mm-hmm. We'd blown up the damn base. And we took down the bunkers or whatever. We blew out. My company was the last company. Hotel was. We walked out of there going up to Kowloon.
This one, Quezon, was ultimately abandoned after the worst of
July,
the fighting.
July 5th of 68. Yeah, we were the last ones out of there. Blew the damn base up. And the ironic thing is we had guys in our outfit, second tours, who had fought there in 67 in the hill fights the year before, up at 881, 861, and they lost Echo 2-3. They lost so many guys up there. And I'm saying to myself, Jesus, we're losing so many people. We're just fighting for territory. But the one thing I got to tell you that to this day, I graduated from college and law school in 1974, and I've been an attorney for a bunch of years. I don't go to college and law school reunions. I go to the Marine Corps.
Peter, I so appreciate your call. Listen, come back to us, if you will. Greg Jones, I mean, this was the ultimate irony. I want to get into the fighting because the losses were terrible. The fighting, as you remind us, I mean, Quezon sort of set the model for what we read about in Michael Hare's classic book, Dispatches, what we saw in so many movies, the bunkers, the close fighting, kind of madness of it all. And then after all that fighting, you know, the soldiers fought and died for this combat base. And yes, of course, as Pete reports, the U.S. Army then, after the thick of the fighting, abandoned it, blew it up, dismantled, walked away.
Absolutely. And both great calls, very powerful and moving. And I wish I had found Pete when I was doing the research for the book. And he's absolutely right about the intensity of the fighting that happened from the date when the siege was officially declared over in early April until the base was abandoned in July of 1968 was incredibly intense. And yet, because General Westmoreland and the McVee Command and Saigon had declared the siege over, that the news media kind of moved on and American attention moved on. And there was very intense fighting and heavy casualties, as Pete has described, in those weeks and months that followed. And unfortunately, we have a short attention span. That certainly was one of the most the bitter things. That one of the veterans whose stories I describe at length in the book is Dennis Mannion, who was an artillery forward observer on Hill 861. And Dennis was still in I Corps, the northern provinces, near the DMZ but closer to the coast in July when he got the word that Quezon was being abandoned. And it was a devastating thing after losing close comrades and after all the struggle and sacrifice and heartbreak to learn that this base, which General Westmoreland had described as indispensable a few months earlier, was now being abandoned. And for Dennis, and I'm sure others, that was a turning point when he came to believe that the war, as it was being executed, was simply not worth it.
Here's General Westmoreland. This is an undated interview. He was commander of U.S. military operations in Vietnam at its peak between 64 and 68, explaining why Quezon, he's saying here, was important to defend.
Quezon was an important outpost. If the enemy had taken this outpost, I think the province of Quang Tri and the DMZ area would have been in jeopardy. The enemy had planned to take it as part of his Tet Offensive. At the same time, he had planned to overrun Quang Tri City, seize and hold Hue, and to roll up our defenses south of the demilitarized zone.
Greg Jones writes up the battle in his new book, Last Stand at Khe Sanh. Greg, out of this whole period from January to July, you focus on 77 days. How did you choose this part? Why?
Well, Tom, when I was first knew I wanted to do a book on Vietnam, that I was immediately drawn to the year 1968. It was a pivotal year. And the two great events, obviously, early on were Khe Sanh and the Tet Offensive, which started January 30th and 31st. So the siege of Khe Sanh actually began on the morning of January 21st. And then you have 9 and 10 days later, the Tet Offensive getting underway.
Which so shook Americans with its images of Viet Cong in cities all over the South in the sense that, oh my God, this thing's totally slipping out of control.
Absolutely. And the context for that that you really point to is for months, the American people have been told by President Johnson, by General Westmoreland and Defense Secretary McNamara that the end was in sight, that all of this escalation and struggle and rising casualties was bringing us close to victory, and that victory was just ahead if the American people would just remain patient a bit longer. And so that's why Khe Sanh and then the Tet Offensive were such staggering events for the American public. Was they had been led to believe that the end was in sight, and suddenly you have an enemy that is striking with very obvious vigor and certainly doesn't appear to be on its last leg. So that certainly was the impact of that. But I very quickly decided that if I wanted to tell the experience of the combat experience of men in the trenches and really take readers into the trenches, I needed to focus on a part of Khe Sanh that was manageable, where I could drill down deep enough and to try to bring to life the experience. And so there had been an incredibly fierce fighting at Khe Sanh in the spring of 1967. It was known as the Hill Fights, and Life magazine had done a big photo spread that a lot of guys that were going through training at the time back in the States were reading about this and seeing these images. And so there had been heavy casualties when the Marines had taken the hill out, the hills guarding the approaches to Khe Sanh the previous year. And I very painfully and purposely had to focus on that period, January through April, in order to really capture it. What I felt was in the fullness and richness and the terror and the heartbreak and brotherhood of that experience.
Here's some sound, this again, from the U.S. military of fighting at Khe Sanh. You hear the planes, the bombs, the gunfire. Greg Jones writes it up in Last Stand at Khe Sanh. You open January 17th, 1968, and you've got Ken Warner, who is, if I've got the date right here, a corporal, a beach kind of guy from California. He's on patrol. The Vietnamese are there, but they can't see them. They don't know where they are. They know there are a lot, but they don't know where, and they're just out looking.
Absolutely. And Ken Warner was he's a wonderful human being, and one of the many Khe Sanh veterans that I really enjoyed interviewing and getting to know during the 3 years I was working on this.
19 years old, he's a surfer, a baseball player, a Dodgers fan from Long Beach, California, and he's deep in that tall elephant grass of Khe Sanh.
Absolutely. The North Vietnamese, American intelligence had indicated that these divisions were moving into place around Khe Sanh, and so Khe Sanh's main role all along had been as a listening post. So you had the special forces and then Marine recon units that were going out in search of the NVA, trying to find where they were, trying to disrupt troop movements and keep an eye on them, really. And as intelligence indicated that you had this this great force converging on Khe Sanh, they were trying to find them, the Americans were, and they weren't having any success. The North Vietnamese were very purposely lying low, so patrols might just come across a warm campfire or a campsite or knapsacks and things like that, but they couldn't find them. And then Ken Warner, on January 17th, as the North Vietnamese, the preparations were nearly complete. They were just about ready to spring this great offensive against Khe Sanh. And so Ken is leading the squad size patrol down off 881 South, and you're absolutely right that it's difficult terrain, elephant grass. He was walking through a stream. Ken liked to range up and down the patrol as it moved, and so he was bringing up the rear. The lead element, the point man, had just stepped into the elephant grass on the far side of a stream, and Ken was the last one to step out. And as he stepped out of the stream, he heard behind him splash, 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 and they were being trailed by North Vietnamese. And the head of the patrol then, they had walked right into an NVA camp, and the NVA had abandoned the camp and were circling around and were somewhere in the grass waiting to spring the attack on them. And so Ken and his men knew they were surrounded and could only hope that they could get out of it, and began to withdraw back across the stream as quietly as they could. But at that point, obviously, stealth was no longer an issue, that the NVA knew where they were, and then slowly withdrew back up the hill. And as they got a little further up the hill, then they were just giddy with relief and amazement that they had lived through this experience. Ken had been waiting for the elephant grass to erupt with rifle fire and RPGs at any second. The NVA weren't ready, and so that's the only thing that spared Ken Warner and his patrol.
Soon enough they were, and it wouldn't be splash, splash. It would be an unbelievable onslaught from the North Vietnamese, from the Americans, from the ground, from the air. Take us into the heart of it, the hell of it, when the fighting was at its fiercest.
Right. It was a really horrific combination of World War I siege warfare and then the jungle warfare that we think of when we think of Vietnam. And so patrols had been limited. Once the siege began, the object was to preserve the American forces and not to get tangled up into something that they couldn't handle, that would require more men, would cost them men, because they were expecting a human wave assault would hit the combat base and the hill outposts, and they would be fighting for their lives in an Alamo-style last stand. And so patrols were drawn in quite close, and basically the days were spent with these moments of terror as heavy North Vietnamese artillery, which was positioned just across the border in Laos at a great massif known as Co Rock, and then mortar teams closer in would pound the base. And any time they would get a target, if they would see two or more Marines, they would fire. There were snipers. And this heavy artillery fire was just terrifying. The men who described it to me would describe the sound of a locomotive about to run them over.
The American bombardment, historic in response from the ground, from the air. Greg Jones writes up the Battle of Khe Sanh in his new book, Last Stand at Khe Sanh. Greg, please stand by in Dallas. Listeners, you can join us. Did you fight at Khe Sanh? Vietnam vets, as you've watched the embrace of vets from Iraq and Afghanistan, what are you thinking, feeling about your own long-ago return? How do we properly honor soldiers from a war that was so deeply controversial? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. You're Jimi Hendrix in 1969 with Machine Gun. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Bruce Springsteen, 1984, was born in the USA, had a brother at Khe Sanh fighting off the Viet Cong. They weren't Viet Cong, they were North Vietnamese Army regulars. Viet Cong would be busy with the Tet Offensive, but it was an enormous battle with enormous losses. My guest today, Greg Jones, writes it up in his new book, Last Stand at Khe Sanh, the U.S. Marines' Finest Hour in Vietnam. We're looking back on Khe Sanh on this day before the Memorial Day weekend, a great and terrible battle, great and terrible losses there. We remember those who were lost. Did you fight at Khe Sanh? 800-423-8255 is our number. And how do we properly honor soldiers from a war that was so deeply controversial? At home, 800-423-TALK. Got all kinds of response from our listeners. Greg Lynn says, I fly my peace flag and try to understand. You've got vets who came home to a very different reception from Iraq and Afghanistan era vets. Ann is calling us from Gallatin, Tennessee. Ann, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I had a husband who fought at Khe Sanh and who was, in fact, medevaced from Khe Sanh. And I had a brother who was killed in Tet. And probably the big difference, or one of the big differences between then and now, is that then it was a draft situation, which also contributed to the problems going on in the, within the United States and the returning vets.
Yeah.
And also, we have a volunteer service at this point in time. But I think that we all need to recognize that every single man who puts, or woman who puts on a uniform should be honored for their courage and their bravery.
It was hard to do. The country often failed in that during the Vietnam War when it was so deeply divisive. But the sacrifices were the same. Your then husband, Ann, I appreciate your call. Greg Jones, Ann is hardly the only one. You write about so many families. What were the ultimate casualties at Khe Sanh?
Well, Tom, if you take the period in late 1967 through July of 68, when the base was abandoned, there were more than 1,500 Americans killed and about 2,500 wounded who were evacuated. So it was... certainly of the 58,000 names on the wall, that a significant chunk of those, and then also the you can, when you walk along the wall, you can just see the duration of the fighting around Khe Sanh and how it stretches over so many panels.
And the Vietnamese losses at Khe Sanh, this often controversial in itself because the deaths were turned out often exaggerated by American military leadership, but what is it presumed or thought to be at this point, the Khe Sanh casualty toll for the North Vietnamese?
It's in the thousands. That, trying to pin it down any more precisely, is there's just a lot of guesswork that the North Vietnamese tended to understate their casualties. And as you noted, it's been well documented that the McVie under General Westmoreland tended to overstate the body count, which became one of the metrics used to gauge success or progress in the war. And so, certainly aerial observers that were flying overhead, they would be able to document substantial casualties. And patrols on the ground, men on the ground would come across bodies, blood trails, bloody bandages and things like that. And there were a lot of graves scattered around Khe Sanh as well, that once the siege was lifted and the Marines began roaming out in the hills more, that they came across a number of graves. So, but it's really hard to say more than somewhere in several thousand North Vietnamese deaths.
Ann in Gallatin, who lost her husband, reminds us that so many of these American soldiers, Marines, were drafted. So they'd go like your Ken Warner from the beach in California into this kind of battle. Take us to the close fighting, what that was like. Take us to the epic American aerial bombardment. Both, Greg.
Right. I'll make one quick side note that the Marines typically were an all volunteer force. Mm-hmm. And so, but the draft was hanging over a lot of young men, and some young men grew up with the belief that that the Marines were the premier force, and so if I'm going in, I'm going to go with the best. And so they joined the Marine Corps for that reason. There was a small in the spring of 68, as the Secretary McNamara's voracious war machine was trying to find more and more bodies, that a small portion of the draftees were put in the Marine Corps because of the heavy fighting from Khe Sanh and Tet had so depleted the ranks. But I would like to just make that point, and I know the Marines are proud for being primarily an all-volunteer force, but certainly the draft was hanging over men. So it the Operation Niagara was what General Westmoreland had conceived of as this veritable waterfall of artillery fire and airstrikes that would pound and punish the North Vietnamese as they drew up against Khe Sanh. And so it was an extraordinary affair, and you had army guns as far as 15, 17 miles back to the east at Camp Carroll that were involved in this, big 175-millimeter guns. And then Khe Sanh itself had guns there that the 113 Marine artillery was there. And so they were firing their howitzers in support of the hill outposts and pounding North Vietnamese targets. So you had this massive operation of where you had forward observers on the hill outposts and men at the combat base that were constantly scanning the jungle and hills around them, trying to find targets.
Just incredible downpour of munitions, of napalm.
Right.
Was Agent Orange used here?
You know, it would have been used in areas around the I Corps, the northernmost provinces, and the jungle areas, and you know, all the Vietnam veterans that I talked to were exposed to it, but you're right. It was you know, napalm was widely used as well, and as well as high explosives and anti-personnel bombs. And so it was a horrific thing to be on the receiving end of that. And I know from reading some of the North Vietnamese documents, histories, and then POW interrogation reports of North Vietnamese prisoners. Just the terror it was to be on the receiving end of a B-52 arc light strike, for example, or some of the other strikes were the close air support also with napalm. These were terrifying things for the North Vietnamese that we don't get to hear about very much.
Terrifying for American pilots as well. The fire was so thick from the Vietnamese that the North Vietnamese could not land. They would fly low and slow, come to the ground. People would jump out the back. They'd take off without even stopping.
Right. It was really a race against time to keep the base supplied, armed, medical supplies and food, and to get the seriously wounded out before the North Vietnamese could really force the issue and either overrun the base U.S. forces would have to attempt a breakout because they were out of food or ammunition. And so obviously the airstrip at Khe Sanh and the helicopter LZs on the hill outposts were magnets for North Vietnamese fire, and the North Vietnamese just pounded anything that moved, and they had a very good system in place where they would track aircraft as they came in, machine guns, and anti-aircraft guns as well. And so it was a really harrowing thing for the fixed-wing pilots and the helicopter pilots. And the hill outposts were totally dependent on helicopters. And the helicopter pilots were the bravest of the brave, really, because they were flying in just extraordinarily dangerous conditions, and choppers were getting shot down. And if they were taking on casualties, for example, Tom, they would have to sit in place, taking fire and not move while
those stretchers were brought. Yes,
absolutely.
Tactical nuclear weapons were considered here by General Westmoreland. He did not want to see this as his Dien Bien Phu. Nukes were. It was considered bringing them out.
It was extraordinary, and the American people years passed before the documents were declassified that revealed the full extent of the discussions underway. And there had been a news leak at the time suggesting that nuclear weapons were being considered, but all this was being denied by the White House, by President Johnson and General Westmoreland. But very much so that the exchange of cables between President Johnson and Earl Buzz Wheeler, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then General Westmoreland over the consideration, do we need to consider using tactical nuclear weapons and chemical weapons? And General Westmoreland's response was, I don't think we'll need them, but there could be the situation where we would be required to use them. And so that was pretty extraordinary. And Westmoreland actually began in February of 68 as the siege was going on, a preliminary look at how they might be used.
Week after week, month after month of terrible fighting at Khe Sanh. The Tet Offensive then going on at the same time back home. It was having a big impression on people. Walter Cronkite came out to Vietnam, saw what was to be seen there, and then this was February 27th. In the middle of this, 1968, Cronkite with his famous turn to skepticism in this on-air Vietnam War editorial.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate. To say that we are closer to victory today is to believe, in the face of the evidence, the optimists who have been wrong in the past. To say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion.
The next month, LBJ, looking out on all the protests against the war in this country, made his announcement he would not run for re-election, would not seek re-election as president. Then in May 23, 1968, President Johnson paid tribute to American Marines and South Vietnamese Rangers who had defended the combat base at Khe Sanh, said the battle to protect those he called them dreary hills was worth the price.
I believe that our initiative toward talks with North Vietnam was greatly strengthened by what these men did at Khe Sanh, for they vividly demonstrated to the enemy the utter futility of his attempts to win a military victory in the South.
Utter irony right there. Of course, the North Vietnam would win. Bob in Nashua, New Hampshire. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Yes, exactly my point. I've always been baffled after the closure of the base at Khe Sanh. I often wondered, and I just heard part of that conversation with General Westmoreland, that the troops there fought and held back and secured Khe Sanh until it was closed. I often say to my friends that after Khe Sanh closed, I felt that the war was over.
Did you serve in Vietnam, Bob?
From the end of 66, I was there the end of 66, 67, 68, 69, and then I left at the end of 69.
Were you in the Khe Sanh area?
Yes, I was.
Were you in the battle?
I was on the outskirts of the battle. As someone mentioned, I was in one of the Marine reconnaissance teams that would go around Khe Sanh observing, like it was very clearly and precisely mentioned. We would be out there knowing that they were there and reporting, providing intel back to our higher echelon as to what our sightings were, what activities were going on.
And you say you felt when it was abandoned, maybe the war was over, or certainly would go on, but maybe lost.
Point, I was an 18, 19-year-old kid, very naive.
Yeah.
I often wondered, why would we do this?
Greg Jones reports in the book that the military just did not want to have to continue that almost indefensible spot. They pulled back. They would still rain artillery down from not far away, but they weren't going to be that vulnerable. Again, one more call, if I may. Greg, Rochester, New York. Brennan is calling. Brennan, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a civilian without any affiliation with the military. I did not fight in the Vietnam War. In fact, I'm 30 years old, quite a younger generation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to revisit the question, are we able to object to war and still respect a warrior? And I would pose this question to your audience. Is that idea universal to every warrior? And this is posed both to war veterans and civilians alike, as we are in a new generation with new kinds of warriors who, like the draft, have little choice in fighting with the Taliban and with countries and offenses that are looked upon as a terrorist organization.
Brennan, our time is so short. Let me give Greg Jones time to respond. Greg, how did you come away from this, all the sacrifice at Khe Sanh in a war that was so controversial, rejected by so many at home on grounds that we have to understand and deeply respect, object to a war, respect the warrior? What about that formula?
Well, one of the things certainly that motivated me as well, Tom, was my sense that Vietnam veterans had been done an injustice when they returned to this country. And I talked with a number of men who returned. And there's a great Marine named Steve Weese, whose story I tell in the book, was with the Bravo 126 that suffered a terrible ambush and then struck one of the first blows, striking NVA positions around the base.
And 22nd Street.
Steve returned and was spat on and called a baby killer and all those things, and it scarred him, and he struggled for a long time to overcome that, and I think that's wrong.
He and many others who came home, you tell their difficult stories in return as well. 90 interviews with Khe Sanh veterans. Of course, many did not come home, and we remember them on this eve of the Memorial Day weekend. Greg Jones tells the entire story in pretty tremendous detail in his new book, Last Stand at Khe Sanh. Greg, thank you for the book. Thank you very much for being with us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.